This is Christina Leffring and Amy Owen with your local news, coming to you from WORT Studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines. A progressive legal group in Madison is calling on the U.S. attorney to investigate two Republican strategists over their targeting of a Milwaukee voting rights group in the 2020 election. The Madison firm, Law Forward, urged the U.S. attorney to investigate in a letter sent yesterday. Those lawyers allege that messages sent between two GOP strategists, one of whom is now the head of the Wisconsin Republican Party, suggests that they could have violated federal civil rights law. In the messages, the strategists discuss plans to overwhelm the Milwaukee-based nonprofit Souls to the Polls with phony requests for transportation on Election Day. Andrew Iverson, who is the executive of the Wisconsin Republican Party, tells Wisconsin Public Radio that his messages were intended as a joke. Meanwhile, the other strategist, Carlton Huffman, was accused in March of sexually assaulting two women in his North Carolina home, reports CNN. Huffman himself is suing American Conservative Union chairman Matt Schlapp for making unwanted sexual advances toward him. He left a job earlier this year as a Republican staffer in the North Carolina legislature.
A former Wisconsin governor and longtime Milwaukee journalist are hoping to restore trust in the electoral process. Former Governor Scott McCallum and former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editorial page editor David Haynes launched the Wisconsin Alliance for Civic Trust, or WISACT, last week. They say the group will seek to build bridges of trust across the political spectrum and head off the threat of political violence, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The group plans training sessions on media literacy and conflict resolution. Its first monthly Zoom meeting is scheduled for the end of the month.
Yet another Wisconsin health system is announcing that it's been hit by a cyber attack. Ascension is one of the largest health systems in the nation. In Wisconsin alone, it operates 24 hospital campuses and more than 100 healthcare facilities. The healthcare giant detected a hack in its systems yesterday, reports the Washington Post. In a statement this morning, Ascension said clinical operations had been disrupted, but that it was still investigating what information was compromised.
Several Madison churches are eyeing the sale, redevelopment, or repurposing of their property as congregation numbers shrink nationwide and religious properties face aging buildings. Isthmus newspaper reports that Eastside Church Common Grace, the product of a merger between Zion Lutheran and Lakeview Moravian in 2020, is seeking to redevelop their property into a community center. Meanwhile, Arbor Covenant Church on Madison's south side will continue to operate its church for the near future, even after selling its property to a nonprofit developer last year. That nonprofit, Commonwealth Development, is slated to connect with community members to find a future use for the property.
The city's finance department reports that 2023 revenue and spending left Madison in a better financial position than expected by an extra $31 million. As a result, Madison was able to deposit $16 million into its rainy day fund at the end of last year, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The city resorts to the rainy day fund to cover short-term shortfalls, as in 2021, when it tapped the fund for $8 million. The fund may get a workout in 2025, when the city projects a $27 million structural budget gap, as rapid growth puts a strain on city services.
Starbucks and its 400 unionized stores are in the process of negotiating a contract. And a barista from Madison State Street Starbucks says she's optimistic that the company will agree to its workers' terms. Last month, Sanua O'Connor represented her co-workers during contract negotiations in Atlanta, reports the Capital Times. The company announced last December that it plans to have contracts in place at all unionized stores this year. Meanwhile, workers at the East Washington Avenue Starbucks voted last month for representation by the Workers United Union. It's the fifth Dane County Starbucks to unionize.
UW-Madison demonstrators held a die-in on Bascom Hill today as finals on campus wind down, but the encampment on Library Mall shows no signs of dwindling. Professors and senior students were invited to dress in their full gowns and regalia, reports the Daily Cardinal, and protesters marked their hands with red paint to represent the murder of Palestinians killed in Gaza. As protesters laid on the iconic hill, one organizer read the names of infants killed in Palestine. That follows as conversations between student protesters and the UW-Madison administration broke down yesterday, with the administration issuing a statement urging that Chancellor Mnuchin herself could not meet protesters' demands to divest funds controlled by UW Foundation. Meanwhile, UW-Madison police say they are investigating three reports of violence near the encampment, including one incident as a possible hate crime.
An experiment that Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway described as a grand closing began yesterday, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. In a brief ceremony, the mayor joined other city officials in declaring the 400 to 600 blocks of State Street off limits to vehicle traffic during peak pedestrian hours, 3 p.m. to 4 a.m. on weekdays and 10 a.m. to 4 a.m. on weekends. The city will survey local residents and businesses and use cell phone data to track pedestrian use before determining whether the mall should become permanent.
Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories. Employees at Meritor Hospital gathered outside their workplace this afternoon for an informational picket. They're demanding better working conditions and wages for the hospital's lowest-paid employees after nearly 3 months of bargaining without a favorable outcome. WORT News producer Faye Parks was there.
The people united will never be defeated! The people united will never be defeated!
Despite the gloomy weather, about two dozen hospital workers and community members gathered outside Unity Point Health Meritor this afternoon. They held signs that read, quote, "Stop turnover, fair contract now," and "We're not striking, we're just practicing," unquote. That's because, despite 3 months of negotiations, the hospital has yet to reach a contract agreement with CNAs, aides, and other employees at Meritor. Today's picket line was purely informational, with workers filing in on their breaks. But picketers tell WORT they're prepared to go on strike if they don't get a fair contract. Unity Point Health has offered service and support workers, who receive the lowest pay at the hospital, a 4% wage increase each year for the next 2 years. Employees say that's not a reasonable increase. Michael Elvord works in environmental services at Meritor in the C-section area, taking care of the operating room's pre- and post-surgical procedure. He's also an executive board member with SEIU Wisconsin, the union that represents Meritor employees.
If you're going to pay your frontline workers that 4%, and you put that up against what we know management, their increases have been, it would not be fair. It would not be reasonable. This is a company that's made $59 million in profit in the last 2 years. We just want a fair, workable wage.
He says Meritor employees have other priorities beyond a wage increase.
We want proper staffing. We want proper respect. We want especially a safe environment for patient care that's going to be the best that it can be.
According to SEIU, Meritor's administrative staff grew by 7% from 2020 to 2022, while frontline staffing went down by 15%. And staff making more than $100,000 a year went up by more than 35% in that time. Elvord says the frontline workers are feeling the pressure of understaffing.
At present time, we probably have about 100 open spots in service and support. So it does put a extra strain on those of us who still work here. It does affect us as far as staffing and retention and our ability to recruit.
State Senator Melissa Agard and State Representative Lisa Subek, both Democrats from Madison, were scheduled to make appearances at the informational picket this afternoon. And AFSCME Local 1, the Wisconsin State Employees Union, has issued a statement in support of the workers at Meritor. Joanna Frosch, a member of Local 1, was at today's picket. She says that Meritor is the hospital of choice for many state workers, and they're invested in the service and support workers' cause.
So when the hospital is clean, when people have good, healthy food for their dietary needs, when the machinery and the equipment and the HVAC is working, that all contributes to the quality of this hospital. None of us want to come into the hospital and end up leaving sicker. And so all of these services help make sure that we don't and keep the hospital running.
The next bargaining session is scheduled for next Monday. Should Meritor workers vote to go on strike, they are expected to issue a 10-day notice. In a statement released after today's picket, Unity Point Health Meritor emphasized their support of staff and said they hoped to reach an agreement in the coming weeks.
I am essential! I am essential!
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
Election season is here, and that means voters are being asked about a range of topics. Rural voters in battleground states who were recently polled seem to favor a number of policies that lean more progressive. However, party affiliation on these matters is lost in the shuffle. Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has more.
President Joe Biden was in Wisconsin Wednesday, touting plans for a new Microsoft data center. The visit comes amid new polling data in battleground states about what's on the minds of rural voters, with organizers noting surprising results. The poll, released by the Rural Democracy Initiative, included feedback from Wisconsin voters. 57% of respondents said they favored a more economic populist vision, with policies centered around lowering costs and raising incomes for the working class. Breakthrough Campaigns researcher Patrick Toomey, who helped lead the poll, says that approach appears more popular than one often touted by GOP politicians.
Just cutting taxes and getting rid of regulations is not going to do the most to help me in this economy.
And while economic policies aligned with Democrats, like minimum wage hikes, are favorable in this poll, many rural voters indicated they think Republicans are doing more for working people. Analysts say that shows Democrats have work to do to rebuild trust in rural areas. Meanwhile, three-quarters of respondents either support abortions or don't want the government interfering with decisions on reproductive health care. Toomey says it will take some time for Democrats to reconnect with these voters and that it won't completely turn around in this election cycle. But he suggests it's not completely hopeless for the party to make gains in rural America ahead of November's vote.
One of the key learnings here is that there are enough voters in rural areas of battleground states who are up for grabs to determine the outcome of 2024.
He suggests if Democrats are savvy with their outreach, they might be able to convince rural populations that they're pursuing policies these voters have outlined as a top priority. More than 1,700 voters in 10 states were part of the poll. As for Biden's appearance, it was at the same location as the Fail the Foxconn project announced by former President Donald Trump several years ago. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Deborah Blum, a Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist and author of notable works like The Poisoner's Handbook, currently the director of MIT's Science Journalism Program, she's also a former faculty member in UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And tomorrow, she'll be giving the keynote speech at the school's graduation ceremony. This afternoon, Blum told our news producer, Faye Parks, that journalism is an evolving field, one that is shifting in favor of nonprofit outlets and collaboration.
Thank you for joining me, Deborah.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I understand you'll be giving the keynote speech tomorrow at SJMC's graduation ceremony. What advice do you have for the young journalists entering the workforce?
I think I'd like to start by just calling out young journalists in a very positive way. If you look at the work of student journalists across the country in covering campus protests and other issues, they've done extraordinary work. In fact, they were publicly recognized by the Pulitzer Board when it gave its awards this year for the courage and determination that student journalists have showed. So I think I would probably start by saying keep it up, right? This is what we want out of journalism: grit, determination, clarity, courage. And so I think that's an essential part of actually being a good journalist. You care about the story. You care about getting it right. And I guess I'd start there. you know, obviously, I would also say be smart. Journalism is an evolving profession. Make sure that you are tracking the evolution and positioning yourself to be in the right place as things go forward.
Yeah, so I'm curious about that. I'm wondering, what do you see as the future of journalism?
So I think there's a couple of things that I see going on now. And, you know, I'm not obviously a great crystal ball reader or I'd be making money in another way. But I do think that we're going to see a shift to more collaborative journalism outlets working together instead of being in perpetual competition. And I think we already see that. ProPublica working with papers around the country. We see small outlets working together. At my program at MIT, we give an award for local science journalism, and I really want to stress the importance of local journalism. The Pew report showed that of the journalists in the United States, the most trusted are local journalists who are known in their community and know their community. So I want to stress the importance of keeping that. There, I think we're going to be looking increasingly at a more subscription-based, more nonprofit model, right? Less dependent on advertising, which has, you know, obviously been difficult to chase in this particular internet age, and more dependent on subscribers and nonprofit support. So, for instance, the MacArthur Foundation and the Knight Foundation, I think it was this year, maybe late last year, said they were committing $500 million strictly going to local journalism. And the last thing I want to say about that is that I think that there we'll see more and more nonprofit model local journalism. We see it now. We see really excellent journalism being done by nonprofits. One in California won the Pulitzer this year. In New England, where I live, VT Digger, which is the nonprofit that covers Vermont, actually has more subscribers than the newspapers there. So we're seeing really good work in that. I think it's important to be aware of that, right? That this is changing, that there may be different skills, but I don't think as people are forever forecasting that journalism is going to go away. I think it's just going to be taking different forms.
So going off of that, we do hear that fairly often, that journalism is sort of a dying profession, a dying field. Do you see any challenges, existing challenges to journalism?
There are huge economic challenges to journalism, and that is not all because of bad choices by newspaper outlets, but hedge funds and other sort of investment pirates have bought up a lot of newspapers, stripped them down for parts, sold the buildings, dismantled the staff, made them into almost minimal publications, shopper publications, we used to call them. Right. I think that that imperils a lot of the local journalism we see today. And I don't know that that's recoverable. That's why I think some of these other models, nonprofit models, collaborative models, are going to start replacing a lot of these small publications, and probably already are. Does that make it a risky profession in some ways? Because we don't know who's going to be replaced and what is going to grow in its place? Yes, right. I think you should definitely be aware going into journalism that, you know, it's not only in a stage of evolution, but at this point, we don't know exactly all the directions we're going to take. And if you are thinking what I want is a nice, stable, reliable paycheck, those exist in journalism as they do in any profession. But you should also be aware that those are harder to find maybe than they used to be earlier. Even in this time where we see journalism at least have the appearance of being under threat, some of the best reporting in the country and the world is being done by both mainstream journalism outlets of old and these new startups. So if you looked at the Pulitzers this year, as you saw, Pulitzers going to nonprofit operations like ProPublica, Pulitzers going to mainstream media, and I actually saw someone on social media saying, look at this, right? There's not a single newspaper owned by a hedge fund that won anything. But we see the newspapers that are still have, you know, some family investment. We see publicly traded publications, and we see nonprofit publications. And that, I think, is the future of journalism.
And so, of course, all of this applies to journalism in general, but your specific niche is science journalism. So do you have any guidance for young people going into that profession?
Sure. I mean, I love science journalism, so I'm always happy to talk about it. To some extent, we went through a period where science journalism was almost immune to some of the pressures we're talking about. People started hiring on during the pandemic. We needed science journalists to explain COVID-19 and vaccines and herd transmission and all of the other things that were really important, how viruses evolve, all of the other things that were absolutely essential to surviving that. We had many places beefed up their climate change reporting staff. And so for a short period of time, science journalists almost looked immune to some of the things we're talking about. That is in a point of correction. Corporate decisions have lost us really good science journalists. Disney, for instance, decided to shut down most of National Geographic, right, which was a longtime great science reporting publication. You know, we've seen some of those kinds of challenges, but I still see an enormous investment in science journalism because everyone recognizes that for better or for worse, science and technology are among the most powerful transformative forces on the planet, and we need to understand them. We need the toolkit that lets us navigate this world that science and technology are building for it, be it AI and the many jobs that are going to be radically altered eventually by that. We continue to see schools investing in training science journalists. We continue to see science journalists being hired even at little startup publications. So I think science journalist is here to stay, and the real challenge for us is, can we do it better, right? And we can always do it better.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Deborah.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
That was Deborah Blum, a Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist and author of notable works like The Poisoner's Handbook. She'll be giving the keynote speech at tomorrow's graduation ceremony for UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Christina Leffring, here with my co-host, Amy Owen. Thanks for joining us. This week on Transparency Talk, WORT's Dylan Brogan and Open Records attorney Tom Kamenick discuss some typical pet peeves when requesting public records and what to do to avoid these annoying but legal technicalities. As always, this conversation is not intended to be specific legal advice, but rather a discussion of general legal issues.
All right, I'm joined by Tom Kamenick, Open Records attorney and all-around good guy. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Dylan. Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday. Let's talk about some pet peeves. What are some of the biggest pet peeves that you hear from your clients and from the public?
Well, let me make a distinction here and kind of define my terms. When I say a pet peeve, I'm not talking about breaking the law, because I don't mind when they break the law so much, because that gives me stuff to do, gives me something obvious I can go after. But when I'm talking about a pet peeve, I mean that they're doing something that's either legal or skating in the gray area, but it's just obnoxious because it's absolutely unnecessary and it does not further the cause of transparency. So it's things that they've learned that they can get away with.
Yeah, and like what we've talked about many times, there are some holes in the laws that records custodians can use to their advantage, potentially. We'll assume they're all doing this with good intentions, but it can get a little annoying. And one of those things you talk about is fees, sandbagging fees. What do you mean by that?
So the law allows the custodians to charge for some of the costs of responding to a record request. The two big ones are for making photocopies and for location fees, which is typically the time it takes somebody to search through records and actually find them before they can review them and turn them over to you. So you'll get sometimes a custodian say, well, our location charge is going to be $60. Pay that up front. You go ahead, pay that a couple weeks, maybe a month later. They say, actually, it took a lot longer and it's actually going to be $500 and you won't get your records until you pay that amount. Technically, that's legal because they just are allowed to charge their cost of location, but you're out the $60 already. And if you can't afford the extra charge, there's not much you're doing about that. So there's nothing in the law that limits them to what their initial quote is.
How much is the most you've ever seen in terms of a location fee or some sort of fee?
Oh, I've seen some in the five figures, so tens of thousands of dollars.
Well, hopefully those were big requests, because I've been quoted over 1,000 for a few hundred pages. What can you do, yeah, right? You got to just pony up.
One I remember was it did involve a massive search of a lot of old paper records. You know, thankfully, in the modern times, electronic records are much easier to search, usually, than the old paper records. But on the other hand, there's just a lot more records. There's a lot more electronic files that exist than ever existed in the paper days. So it's a bit of a trade-off, you know? So they have...
Yeah, maybe they just don't review them as thoroughly. I don't think people would mind that. All right, so what can you do when you, all of a sudden, you think you're getting your records, you put down $60, but now it's, you know, much higher?
Ideally, you start early and try to head this problem off before it comes. It's to make sure that they understand the scope of your request and you understand what they're searching. So if they give you a quote for a price of how much, ask them, what are you going to be searching through? Are you searching through boxes, or is this electronic? Are these off-site? Is it just one file cabinet? Is it one folder? Sometimes even electronic records can't be searched quickly if they've been archived. Sometimes individual archive files need to be unzipped and brought up and searched one at a time. So that can take a lot. So you can talk about narrowing your request. You can certainly negotiate and bring up that after this happens, to say, look, you told me it was going to be this much, $60. Now you're telling me $500. You know, that's a really bad look for you. You know, if are you doing this a lot? You shouldn't be sandbagging people like this. Can we find a way to reach a compromise on this? You know, you can always ask for a reduction on it. There is a particular provision of the law that says that they can waive any charges. So don't ever let them tell you we have to charge you this.
Another one of pet peeves when dealing with open records is you ask for a record that, and they come back with, oh, we don't have that record. Give us some examples of where this has come up in your work.
You need to be very careful what you're asking for. The law says that you can ask for a record. So specifically, if you ask a question, how much was budgeted for the police department last year? That's not a record request. If they don't have to answer it, ideally, I would hope they would for their constituents, but they don't have to. It's not a record request. Even if you phrase it as a request just for information, can you provide me how much the police department budget was? That's not the same thing. You need to ask for a record. So ideally, you know the name of the record. I want the police department's budget for, budget document for the last year. If you know a form number, if you know the name of something, that's the best way. If you don't, you can still get information like that. You still have to phrase it as a request for a record. So you say, I am requesting records that show what the police department's budget was for last year. So as long as you phrase it as a request for a record, that can get around that. Sometimes you might ask for, like a lot of times I've seen people ask for like a list of things. Like, I want a list of all the employees and their salaries in the department. If you get a response saying, we don't have a responsive record, we don't have that record, one of the best things to do is ask the custodian, well, what do you have? What records are in your office that would have that information on that? And if you've got a custodian, like they very often do take their responsibilities seriously, they will help you identify that. You know, it's in their best interest to help you get what you want with a minimum of effort as well. So if there's a single document in their possession that answers your question, they might be willing to tell you what that is so you can ask for it.
Don't get tripped up by semantics is the point. And I would say, by and large, most public
first answer,
most public records custodians aren't out to trick you so blatantly. But hey, you know, they could if they wanted to. So be careful of that. All right. Well, finally, Tom, you know, one thing that's very frustrating, you ask for a record and then it turns out it's just kind of a bad record. Like, it's incomplete because they didn't give it to you, but just because it should have information but doesn't. So walk us through that one.
So the record law does not require them to create certain records for you. So if they don't have what you're looking for, even if they're supposed to have it, the record law doesn't require them to create it. I see this come up a lot in minutes. Minutes for governmental body meetings of, you know, your last city council meeting, the school board meeting. If they don't have the minutes, you can't request them yet. If they have minutes and they're really, really sparse and they barely say anything, well, that's the document you have and that's what they're going to get. If they're not keeping good minutes, that's a political issue. And you know, you vote the bums out if they're not doing a good job of that. But I'll be honest, minutes these days are about as bare as they can possibly be from most places that I see. I feel like that they feel like they don't want to get caught on anything. So they do the absolute bare minimum.
Well, we've definitely seen this with larger government organizations, but let's hope the trend continues. And I think the pandemic really sped it along. Hey, record these meetings. You should be able to attend them virtually. You should be able to watch them later. And any good local official should encourage that.
Yeah. And sometimes you find things on the recording that are different than the official minutes. And you can bring that up to your local government and say, well, you know, your minutes say that you voted to spend $400,000 on this project, but I watched the recording and the motion was $300,000 and that needs to be corrected. And you can try to get them to do that.
Attorney Tom Kamenik, keeping us all honest. Thank you so much, Tom.
You're welcome, Dylan. And remember, everybody, if you don't ask, you won't know.
Anglers rejoice. Fishing season is now fully open. And even better, the weather this weekend is looking perfect to go out and hit the water. Nate Wegehout and Pat Hasberg take a look at what's happening on this week's Fishy Business.
All righty, I'm on the line now with Pat Hasberg over at the DNS Bait Shop here in Madison. Pat, fishing season finally fully open. I was able to get out, do some trout fishing this weekend. I did catch a couple trout, mostly suckers, but it was still a beautiful time to get out last weekend, and it's looking like this coming weekend going to be nice once again. So taking a look at what's happening around the Madison area.
Well, you're right. It really was a nice weekend to have for the opener of the fishing season, and we had a lot of people coming through the shop here, a lot of folks getting out, and the fish have been in a great mood lately. So generally around town, everything is up shallow pretty much, so 10 feet of water or less. But when I'm saying everything, I mean literally everything. Walleyes, bass, pike, panfish, everything's up there, and they're all hungry this time of year, so... lots we can talk about.
All right, then let's start talking about it and go down the list. Lake Mendota, what's happening?
Well, up here on the north side in Cherokee Marsh, which is technically considered part of Mendota, their crappies and bluegills have been moving in there. Down at the 113 Bridge, a lot of good large catfish down there. That action's been really great the last few weeks. Out on the lake itself, like I said, most of your fish are going to be shallow, but they're getting walleyes, bass, a lot of pike around in the system. The Tenney Park area has been great, especially the area below the locks there has been good, but that's always the case this time of year. And yeah, I mean, it's just a really great time to be out on the water.
Moving across the way, Lake Monona, what's happening?
Yeah, so down on Monona has been also really great, pretty much the same deal down there. A lot of fish, all your fish basically are up shallow, so but the best bite down that way has been for the crappies and the bluegills on Monona Bay and the triangles down there. But also, you know, a lot of bass up shallow. The musky bite hasn't quite turned on yet. Those fish are just done spawning, so they're a little lethargic, but plenty of pike in the system. And, again, a really great time to be out on the water. All your shallow bays are going to be full of fish right now. So Weechobuck Bay, Turbo Bay, the Winnequa Lagoon area up there in Monona, all are holding fish right now.
And now let's move on over to Lake Wingrow. What's happening there? Anyone seeing any muskies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I even heard the muskies. So the area below the Wingrow Dam is still closed, even though fishing season is open. They closed that until mid-May. And if you went down there right now, you'd probably still see some muskies swimming around trying to jump up the little dam, the spillway there. But otherwise, in the lake itself, I'm sure there's a few muskies being caught in there. But really, the largemouth bass population is really starting to get better and better in there. And there's some really nice quality fish in there. So it's a great place to take advantage of some largemouth bass fishing before the weeds get too crazy. And, of course, there's tons of small bluegills and other panfish in there if you're looking to keep a little person busy. But, the area below the dam is closed until, I believe, it's May 15th. So that's something that folks should keep in mind.
and moving down a little bit, Lake Wabisa and Upper Mud. What's happening?
As you move down the chain through Monona, there's the Lattice Park area, sort of where the old Rutabaga used to be right off the bat line. That's got a lot of panfish in there right now. Upper Mud Lake near the dredge hole, sort of on the, I guess it'd be the east end of Upper Mud Lake, also is holding a lot of fish. The area around the dredge hole is shallow flats, holding a lot of bass right now. They've got their pre-spawn feed bag on right now, so they're hungry and looking to get ready to spawn. Down on Wabisa, they're getting fish in the Lake Farm Park area, and down on the south end of the lake near Goodland Park, they call that South Bay down there. And I've been hearing about a few walleyes and crappies being picked up between Babcock and the Bible Camp area there, down on kind of the southeast end of the lake. And I did want to mention, too, that the area below the Babcock dam there is now open. It was closed as a fish refuge there, so that's open to fishing again, too.
Last lake we're going to look at, the Mystery Lake, the one that I guess this is the first real report of the year. Lake Caganza, are we going to be hearing too much about it today? What's going on?
Well, you know, I actually have heard about a decent bite down there, mostly right where the Yahara River dumps in on the north end of the lake near Fish Camp County Park. They've been getting some fish up there. That's a large shallow flat that warms up early. And then plus that current kind of draws fish up in there. So a lot of panfish in there, but I have heard about a few walleye being picked up and a few walleye also being picked up along the state park. So, yeah, usually Caganza is known to be a hit or miss lake, but right now it seems to be hitting pretty good.
And because I want to make sure that we have time for it, Pat, what's happening with the trope bite? I already gave my report a little bit there. I did catch one pretty decent-sized brown trout over a little west of here. I won't say exactly where, but what's happening with the trout bite?
The trout are also in a good mood. So the only thing that's been kind of a factor in whether or not folks have had success has been some of the rain we've had. So when rain comes through, it makes the streams a little higher and dirtier. So that can make trout fishing a little bit challenging. But I've been out a few times myself. I prefer to do fly fishing. And there have been a lot of fish looking up. Caddisflies, blue-winged olives have been really effective. I've been hearing about a few folks seeing crane flies come off. But on the spinning gear side of things, you know, if you've got a small Rapala, Panther Martin spinner, little Cleo spoon, all of those things work great this time of year. But also now that fishing season is rocking and rolling, you can use live bait. So it's really hard to beat just a small red worm on a hook under a bobber and drift that through some little riffles and runs. And those fish will readily grab a red worm.
I was going on half a night crawler. That's my go-to every time. Half a night crawler, just
go.
Have that go up right on through the hole. Well, Pat, I think that'll just about do it for today. Before we go, any final fishing advice for all the people out there?
Well, you know, just make sure you get out and enjoy the great spring fishing that, you know, is ahead of us. And it's nice to have the season open, but do make sure you check your regulations. They did lower the walleye bag limit down to 3. And then on Lake Mendota only, here on the Madison chain, the panfish limit has been lowered down to 10 fish that you can keep. So just make sure you check your regulations before you get out.
You can pick up one of those little booklets pretty much anywhere that you can buy a fishing license in person. I always keep one of those in my car. It's been really useful to have in case you're out fishing somewhere that doesn't have internet and you can't check there. Well, Pat, thank you so much for talking with me again this week. Remember, you can hear an updated fishing report anytime that you want just by calling 608-BIG-FISH. Pat, thank you again and good luck out there.
Always a pleasure, Nate. You take care.
Forward Madison have built a passionate fan base, in part through a fun brand and trend-setting jerseys. What many don't see is their behind-the-scenes efforts to make a positive impact in the community, especially in youth soccer. More now from Forward Focus.
Hello again and welcome to everyone listening to WORT Online and 89.9 FM on your radio dial. This is another edition of Forward Focus, a segment devoted to any and all things Forward Madison FC, Wisconsin's only fully professional soccer team. I'm one of your hosts, Grant Peters, assistant editor for cultural and Forward Madison-themed magazine New Dogmazine. As always, the editor of NDZ and the producer of Forward Focus is Andrew Schmidt. When we last left you, FMFC was about to begin play down in Kentucky for USL1's inaugural Jägermeister Cup as they took on Lexington SC. Looking frustrated and out of sorts for most of the match, and despite Lexington being issued not one but two red cards, and Ford Madison playing at one point with a two-man advantage, they still were unable to find the back of the net and gave up a late goal, which delivered the Flamingos a disappointing 1-0 defeat to open cup play. Following that, Ford Madison returned home for USL1 league play to take on Greenville Triumph SC this past Saturday. Wolfgang Prentice got the action started right away as he found himself all alone in the box and slotted home an Azeem Bartman pass to give FMFC a 1-0 lead just 1 minute into the match. Greenville would fight back, however, getting a goal before halftime and another 8 minutes after the half to give them a 2-1 lead. Ford Madison would rally, however, as Derek Gebhardt was taken down inside the box, earning FMFC a penalty kick. Christian Chaney stepped up to slot home the penalty for his first league goal of the season and to tie the match at 2 apiece. Ford Madison would then provide some late drama, as in the 93rd minute, following an exhibition of pure hustle and effort, newcomer Sharif Jay's cross, following a beautiful dummy by Chaney, would find the foot of Juan Galindrez, who buried it home, sending the FMFC faithful into a frenzy and giving Ford Madison a 3-2 victory. For this week's segment, we sat down with FMFC superfan and one of the coaches for Millennium Soccer, Steve Tickner. Steve and his squad had their very own pro day at Breeze last Saturday, and we got his thoughts on how FMFC really walks the walk when it comes to being a community club and how their mission aligns with Millennium's. Andrew, take it away.
We are here with Forward Madison superfan and Millennium Soccer Club coach Steve Tickner. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
This last weekend, we noticed an influx of young talent, mostly in the Flocken, but kind of all over the stadium. Very vocal. We found out this was largely your doing. We learned that your indoor team got basically a pro day out at Bree Stevens with a media day photo shoot and a bunch of other stuff. Tell us a little bit about what that day was like on Saturday.
Well, I have to say it was an amazing collaboration with Forward, the club, Alyssa, and then the president of Millennium, Haley, all of us kind of coming together to make this happen. But yeah, we've had this indoor team for 3 sessions now at TOCA, and we're invited to play in the Mesa Cup coming up in a few weeks. Alyssa said, you know, we can design some jerseys for them. So we brought them in. All the kids designed their own versions of these jerseys, and then their team put together kind of a combined jersey of all of these concepts.
Oh, so yeah, super cool.
They made them, gave us a media day, a full kind of fledged media day. Every kid got the professional do up, all the lights and cameras, professional pictures. Then we got to play on the field, got to have a little bit of a practice session before the game, got a little tour, behind the scenes tour. So we got to see a lot of areas that aren't normally seen by fans. We got to see the locker room beforehand. It was really cool. The kids were jazzed to see all of that and to know that they would be wearing jerseys very similar to kind of what the professionals are wearing. And then obviously we stuck around for the game and got to see everything kind of come together. And you saw it yourselves, just the energy of the kids being able to see soccer at a professional level right in their hometown.
Why is it so important for these kids that are, you know, playing soccer with you at a youth level to be able to go and, you know, and see their professional team in their hometown and like get that kind of experience?
It's really cool going to the games and seeing the passion. That's why I fell in love with Ford, is just the passion that people have for the sport itself. And a lot of the kids that come into kind of the Millennium program, this might be their first time playing soccer. And we're really trying to instill that love of the game, but also tease out a little bit of the, you know, what you can learn about life through facing adversity and teamwork and, you know, all that kind of fun stuff. Some of our volunteer coaches are kids that play for the local high schools. So you kind of see this pipeline kind of building. They might have grown up in different clubs, and now we have Millennium, which is trying to make soccer accessible to kind of every kid, no matter what their situation is, really helping them fall in love with the sport and then seeing it in the larger context that is the professional kind of atmosphere at Breeze. Cool to see them connect, you know, this game that they come show up on Saturday to play. Then they come into kind of this indoor setting where we actually have refs and more formal rules, giving a little bit more format to the game. See their coaches that, you know, play for high school, and then ultimately kind of the fanfare, the drums, the music, the energy, all of that combining to kind of really hype them up, give them a sense of what soccer could look like, you know, at the grand scale, and to know that it's right here in their own backyard. You know, they have those professional players that they can give high fives to. I mean, it was just really cool to see everything kind of come together in this one day.
What can people and the community do to help the mission of Millennium Soccer Club?
We're always looking for volunteers. You know, we have sessions spring, fall, summer. It doesn't take any experience whatsoever to come volunteer. The other thing is donations are huge. If you don't have time to volunteer, consider making a gift towards Millennium. It goes directly towards kind of the equipment that we use, making sure registration fees for indoor, all that kind of stuff is covered. All the unfun stuff so that kids can go out and have fun and learn a little bit about life through soccer. Check out MillenniumSoccerClub.org or follow the Instagram, follow the Facebook. Get pretty regular updates over those socials as well.
Ford Madison FC is back in action this Saturday as they head down to North Carolina to face the Charlotte Independents in their second match in the Jägermeister Cup. Kickoff is at noon and live coverage is available on ESPN+. Following that, FMFC heads back out on the road for league play as they'll fly out to Washington to take on USL1 newcomers Spokane Velocity FC on Sunday, May 19th. Kickoff is at 5 p.m. local time, and live coverage will again be available on ESPN+. And that'll do it for this week. As always, we hope that you'll join us again as Andrew and I continue to keep you up to date on all the news, updates, and stories coming out of Bree Stevens Field as Forward Madison continues their quest for USL1 glory. For WORT, this has been Forward Focus.
And that does it for our show. Thank you for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Special thanks to feature contributors Dylan Brogan and Tom Kamenick, Nate Wiggehaupt and Pat Hasberg, and the Forward Focus crew. Nicole Alley engineered the show, Faye Parks produced this podcast, or this newscast, and Shali Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Christina Leffring.
And I'm your host, Amy Owen. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Good night.